morning. I appreciate all of you for your attendance, the encouragement that you are just by being here, and for all the things that we've enjoyed and done together. And thank you to the McDivitt clan for Ted, was it about 1983 when we met?
I think it was at Baldwin, Michigan.
Yeah. It's been a long and a very rewarding fellowship and friendship for me, and been a joy and a blessing to see your family grow, and so many things that have happened. Donna, I'm letting you off easy today. Donna's passing out a short syllabus. It's only 4 pages today. We had 6 yesterday. And Barb Camacho, thank you for the song that goes so well with what I'm going to talk about.
Rick picked it out, so you know.
Rick picked it out?
Everything is in the
heart. Oh, well, it's going to be just perfect. Well, Donna's getting this... these things passed out. I'd like to suggest a thought to you this morning. In Romans 5, in verse 14, we have a phrase there. It speaks of Adam. It says, who is a type of him who is about to be. It says, basically, that Adam is a type of Christ. I want to suggest to you that this is part of the secret that was revealed to Paul. Have you ever thought of, is there anywhere else in the Bible that really speaks of Adam as a type of the Messiah or a type of the Son of God? In the Old Testament, it would only be in a vague sense. But then when we come to the New Testament, we've got Paul saying so many things like, as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Romans 5, 18 and 19. Through the disobedience of one, the many were constituted sinners. So by the obedience of the other one, the many shall be made righteous. And over he's saying these things. He calls Christ the second man and the last Adam, and a lot of things in the people wanting to see this doctrine or study that doctrine always go to Paul. So I think we're going to see this in a special way today, but we're going all the way back to Genesis 1 to do it and to start our study there. I'd like to talk today about the realms of the secret. And that's the title on the handout. And think for a moment about the creation and how it's presented. Those 6 days of creation before the rest, there's a repetition there. And this is what I'd like to point out in this chart that we handed out. And on the left side, days 1, 2, and 3, we have the realms of man's environment. And then to the right, we're going to compare with that those realms being filled and ruled. On day 1, there was light above the earth. On day 2, there was creation of an atmosphere and division of waters above and below it. And on day 3, we have the division of the waters and the land coming forth out of the waters and the growth of all the plants. Now, notice at day 4, how that parallels day 1. The sun, moon, and stars became visible, and they were there for seasons and for times and for ruling of the day and ruling of the night. So you can see the relationship between them. On day 5, we have the creation of the aquatic animals and the flying creatures that fill the atmosphere and the waters that were spoken of on day 2. And then on day 6, we have the creation of the land creatures and humanity that were on the land that came forth on the 3rd day. So we've got a repetition of these different realms. We've got the land and the sky and the sea, don't we? Three different realms of man's environment. And what we're going to see, and what I'm going to look at in just a moment, is how these represent three realms of the kingdom. Three realms of the kingdom. All right. The sixth day we have also, it said that humanity was to rule over the land, over the sky, and over the sea creatures. And this was all in man's environment. But as we think of that, we have Adam doing this, but he's actually representing Christ and how Christ is going to be ruling over the parallel realms with this. All right. And that's really what's stated in the paragraph here between to the next chart. Man's environment has three realms, earth, sky, and sea. He is to rule over these. These are a type of the three realms of Christ will be Lord over in the kingdom, heaven with the spiritual beings, earth with the nations, and Hades was the realm of the dead and of imprisoned spirits. Now let's look at how the Bible reveals this. And actually, on my copy, if you want to do this, there's a little bit of space where it's over the realm, where it speaks of realms of the Old Testament. I wrote camouflage there, right above the Old Testament, or just camo if you want. Because actually, God is revealing something, but he's also using it as one of these screens that you couldn't really see through, because he's hiding something at the same time he's revealing it. And I think we'll see this here in a minute. Looking then at realms in the Old Testament, the first one, so Elohim created humanity in his image, in the image of Elohim he created it. Male and female he created them. Elohim blessed them, and Elohim said to them, be fruitful and increase, fill the earth and subdue it, hold sway over the fish of the sea and over the flyer of the heavens, over every domestic beast, over all the earth and over every animal that is moving on the earth. Now let's see what Paul says and how he speaks of these parallel realms, on the realms of the revealed secret. And going to Philippians chapter 2, Christ being inherently in the form of God empties himself, coming to be in the likeness of humanity, being obedient unto death. God highly exalts him and graces him with the name that is above every name, that in the name of Jesus every knee should be bowing. And where are these knees and where are these tongues? Celestial, terrestrial, and subterranean, the heavenly, the earthly, and the dead. You see how parallel this is to Genesis 1. It's so close to saying, Christ changes the realms of the human environment to the human and spiritual realms. He changes the realms of the animals. God is using the realms and the animals to represent these realms of the kingdom that his son will rule over. It's a tremendous thing, and I think one of the biggest lessons of the first chapter of Genesis, it starts out saying it was darkness, chaos, and vacant. And then by the time we get to man ruling, and on that last day it doesn't even mention the darkness anymore. It's not chaos, but there's rule. And instead of vacancy, everything is filled with life. The sea is full of life. The land is covered with life. The air has life flying all through it. And this is really a picture of what God is going to do with his kingdom and the way he's going to change the way things are in this world right now and what we see all around us. He's got a great plan to change it all. Okay, under the next section in the chart, the realms in the Old Testament, we've got a partial quotation here of Psalm 8. And Psalm 8 is very much like Genesis 1. It repeats a lot of the same ideas, but it also adds information that's really very important. O Yahweh our Lord, from the mouth of the unweaned and sucklings, you have founded strength because of your foes to cause the enemy and the avenger to cease. God has enemies. And he's not just going to beat them because he is so powerful and he can do anything, but he's going to take some weak, feeble little, and this is why he called me to study the Bible and give a message now and then, because he can use squat to do anything. Okay? That's the way he, and the when that happens, then the glory goes to him, doesn't it? Yeah. And that's what it's all about. I see your heavens, the work of your fingers. What is the mortal that you are mindful of him, or a son of mankind that you are visiting him? You make him lack a little of the messengers. With glory and honor you crown him. You give him the rule over the works of your hands. All have you set under his feet, flocks and domestic animals, all of them, beasts of the field and birds of the heavens, fish of the sea. That's all in Psalm 8, and it's sort of an abbreviated or condensation of it here. But in Hebrews chapter 2, the writer of Hebrews goes back to Psalm 8, and he talks about it, and he adds some things. And so I want to read part of that. There'll be verses here under the realms of the revealed secret. First of all, he says, not to messengers does he subject... I forgot to check. What time did I start?
You're fine.
I think about those after. Not to messengers does he subject the impending inhabited earth. Now, if we were to go back to the Old Testament, we would find that God said, all right, there in Deuteronomy, that he, well, it was after the Tower of Babel, and he divided up the nations, and he set the sons of God, or angels, over these nations to rule them. And then he said, I'm going to make my own nation. I'm going to start with Abraham and make a nation of my own. Well, he says now, the one we've been waiting for is here. Christ has come. And angels, they're not going to be ruling here in the future. It's going to be Christ and his people who are doing the ruling. Not to messengers does he subject the impending inhabited earth concerning which we are speaking. And he gives some verses there from Psalm 8. And then he says, and notice, I've got in bold print the word all. It's seven times repeated here, which is really emphatic. And even the concordant version in one of these gives everyone. But it's seven times it's all, and it reaches beyond just humanity for sure. All dost thou subject underneath his feet. For in the subjection of all to him, he leaves nothing unsubject to him. Yet now we are not as yet seeing all subject to him. We haven't seen everything brought under Christ's feet yet. Yet we are observing Jesus, who has been made some bit inferior to the messengers because of the suffering of death, wreathed with glory and honor, so that in the grace of God he should be tasting death for the sake of all. For it became him because of whom all is and through whom all is, and leading many sons into glory, to perfect the inaugurator of their salvation through sufferings, all those being hallowed are of one. There's a change here. Christ made lower than in the angels for the suffering of death, and now exalted above them. And he's using this. This is part, and it's not the whole thing, but this is part of his interpretation of Psalm 8. And so he's changing the realms of man's environment to the realms of the kingdom here again. Page 2.
Hey, that's one of the more profound passages in the Bible.
I think it is too, Ted. It's tremendous and very weighty. It really is. Now, I'm going to read next. This Deuteronomy passage was Moses speaking to the children of Israel when they were getting ready to go into the promised land. And they were all kind of mumbling and grumbling, well, how are we going to do this? And how's it going to happen? And so forth. And anyway, Moses said, this instruction am I giving to you today. It's neither too difficult for you, nor is it too far away. It's neither in the heavens for you to say, who shall ascend into the heavens for us and take it for us and announce it to us that we may do it? Nor is it across the sea for you, not your, but for you to say, who shall cross across the sea for us? And he goes on to say, and take it and bring it back and tell us how to do it. Now, the reason I quote this is because Paul quotes this passage in Romans, and it's right across the page, and I didn't give the full thing, the full passage here, but Romans 10, verses 6 through 8, and we're going to notice that he changes the sea and the heaven here. You may not be saying in your heart, who will be ascending into heaven? And he explains, that is to be leading Christ down. Or who will be descending into the submerged chaos? Talking about the sea. That is to be leading Christ up from among the dead. So Paul changes the sea to death, representing death, and he changes the idea of the heavens. He really focuses in on the ascension of Christ. All right, our last one. From Matthew, it's also this very similar verse also in Luke. A generation wicked and an adulteress for a sign is seeking. This is Jesus speaking. And a sign will not be given to it except the sign of Jonah the prophet. For even as Jonah was in the bowel of the sea monster 3 days and three nights, thus will the Son of Mankind be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. Jesus changes the sea to death. The realm of the sea and the fish and all that, he says this is representing Hades. And we even have the poetic statements of Jonah and his prayer from the belly of the whale or whatever it was that he was in, that he had gone down to the roots of the sea or the, I can't remember
the
his
weeds
word.
Wrapped around his head.
Yeah, and the weeds, like the crown of thorns. Yeah, and he says, from the belly of hell or from the belly of Sheol, I cried, and God heard him. So Jesus has the sea representing Hades. We've got some space there. I should have put in some more. I'm going to give you a couple references if you'd like to write them down. Right across from the Matthew 12:39-40 verses. If you'd like to write down Matthew 8:29, also Luke 8:31. Those are two passages covering the same area. And then also Revelation 20, verses 2 and 3. Matthew 8:29, Luke 8:31, Revelation 20, 2 and 3. Now these verses in Matthew and Luke are talking about Christ coming over to the land of Gadara, or Gennesaret, we've got different names used. And there he meets this demon-possessed man. He says, what's your name? And the name is, my name is Legion, for we are many. And I gave both of these references because the demons speak through this man, and one of them says, if you come to torment us before the time. And then the other one is, gives us, they said, don't send us into the sea. And it was the Sea of Galilee. But we have an equation here, and if we look at Revelation, we have the same word of the abyss or submerged chaos used in Revelation. Where is the dragon put? And the dragon is representing Satan and his kingdom. into the abyss. They're locked in the deep. And so we have these New Testament verses making a parallel, giving us, changing the idea of the sea into the place of death and Hades. So all of these, you see, all of these realms are revealed to us. And this is part of the secret, really partly explained by Christ here, as we can see, but it really comes out in the New Testament, and especially through Paul, especially Philippians 2, 9 through 11. The great things there. I say under that, we're speaking God's wisdom in a secret, wisdom which has been concealed, which God designates before the eons for our glory. For not one of the chiefs of this eon knows, for if they know, they would not crucify the Lord of glory. God used the realms of earth, sky, and sea to represent something. And the New Testament reveals that these are the realms of the kingdom. And because he did this, and we see what he has done, we can look back. We can look back at Psalm 8. We can look back at Genesis 1. And we can see God had this figured out all along. He had a plan, and he talked about it, but it was veiled under the idea of man's environment, you see. And so he was revealing it for us later when the secret's revealed to us. But at the same time, he was hiding it from the chiefs of this eon so that they would not stop from crucifying Christ as they did. So this should be something to bolster our faith. This should be something to give us confidence in God. And yet at the same time, he's actually opened a window for us to see how he was working and how the secret could be kept. Tremendous thing. Let's talk for a moment about the loneliness of Christ. And I want to do this by reading in Genesis, and we have this all printed out there for you, down below, under the loneliness of Christ. Yahweh Elohim said, "It's not good for the human to be alone by himself. I shall make for him a helper as his complement." Yahweh Elohim had formed from the ground every animal of the field, and every flyer of the heavens, and he brought each one to the human to see what he would call it. And whatever the human would call it, each living soul, that was its name. So the human was calling the names of every domestic beast, and every flyer of the heavens, and every animal of the field. Yet for the human, no helper was available as his complement. You notice I've got a little footnote there on the word available, and if we look down below, this was available. According to the concordant version, literally, it was found. And the King James Version is actually better on just presenting what this. And, you know, for the longest time, this part of Genesis 2 made no sense for me. Why in the world does he have Adam looking through all these animals for a compliment when he already said he's going to make one for him? Why? Why did he do that? Let's go ahead with the passage. Then Yahweh Elohim caused a stupor to fall on the human. While he was sleeping, he took one of his ribs, and I don't like the angular organ. It's basically the word side. It's a construction term, and there's a good reason why he used a construction term. It's Jim Harmon and South Carolina says, I've talked to a Hebrew professor, and he says, that's not the word for rib. And I says, it's not supposed to be the word for rib because of the way God talks about building, and we'll get into that in a minute. And closed up the flesh over its place. Yahweh Elohim built. Now, the King James Version says made. The Hebrew says built. Yahweh Elohim built the rib that he had taken from the human into a woman and brought her to the human. the human said, this time, and I've got another footnote here, and I'm giving you what the Concordant Version has. There's a dot that means a definite article is there, and then there's a little du for duration, which is the word. This the duration. And a lot of translations translate that as finally, but literally, this the duration. Have you ever thought about how long Christ has waited for his compliment? What God has done here in Genesis chapter 2, he's using Adam and Eve, but he's representing Christ and the timetable. And this is why we have so much trouble trying to understand Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. In chapter 1, the man and the woman, they're made on day number 6. And then we come to Genesis 2 and say, well, here the woman's not made until after the man and after the animals and all this sort of stuff. We're trying to put it all together. But the secret is that he's giving us this timeline, the chronology relative to Christ. And he's going to be shadowing forth the complement of which we are a part. And so that's why it's so difficult to see here, and why I've been talking about these realms. If we go back up to the first paragraph of this section, Yahweh Elohim formed from the ground every animal of the field and every flyer of the heavens. This search was through heaven and earth. Okay? The sea's not mentioned. Of course, death hasn't entered yet either, so there's not really much need to mention it. But God, when God has a job to do, he chooses the most qualified. He's careful about this. We're going to look at his searching. But if you think about these two realms, heaven and earth, I can't think about those two realms without thinking about the book of Ephesians, because first chapter we have the administration of the complement of the eras, the administration of the remaining time periods, an administration which operates both in heaven and on earth. And then we go to the third chapter, and he's talking about the secret, and he's talking about which in previous generations was not made known to the sons of humanity. And then he goes down and he says, and now it's being made known to the celestial realm in the heavens. And then we go to the sixth chapter and he says, you're not going to be struggling against flesh and blood, but your struggle's with heaven and earth, heaven and earth, heaven and earth, all through Ephesians. And that's the book more than any other that talks about the complement of Christ. The complement of Christ. The man said, this time it's bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This shall be called woman, for this was taken from her man. Therefore a man shall forsake his father and his mother. He will cling to his wife, and both of them will be one flesh. How come it doesn't say the wife will leave her parents and cling to her husband? Because she's representing us. And we can't leave where we are and go to Christ. He had to come to us. He had to come to us. Now, I'm going to use the word complement, and this is a confusing word because Dan Kramer was talking this morning about how terrible English is and all these words. He says, when it says eight, I don't know if it means A-T-E or E-I-G-H-T or, you know, is all these, we've got all these words that are the same. And we got the same thing with compliment. A compliment we use with it when we have it with an I is to praise or to show esteem for. And I found out in searching this word that it was actually the idea of fulfillment of courtesy, and considered the proper way approach people. That was the old French definition. But the compliment we're using here, spelled with an E, talks about that which completes or fills something up. We have in Mark 2:21 the idea of the garment. A patch is put into a garment to fill it up. The patch isn't the fullness of the garment, but the patch makes the garment whole. And Romans 11:25, until the complement of the Gentiles has come in, until those, the number of Gentiles needed to complete the body, when they come in, it doesn't mean all the Gentiles, but the part that makes it complete. All right, now I want to read from Ephesians to help us tie these things together. Thus the husbands, at the bottom of page 2, thus the husbands also ought to be loving their own wives as their own bodies. He who is loving his own wife is loving himself, for no one at any time hates his own flesh, but is nurturing and cherishing it, according as Christ also the Ecclesia. For we are members of his body. For this a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. This secret is great. Yet I am saying this as to Christ and as to the Ecclesia. So Paul takes us clear back to this confusing passage in Genesis 2 and says he's talking about Christ and the church, Christ and his complement, Christ and us believers. Well, how does God conduct a search? I'd like to have an example here because I think we've seen this search through heaven and earth for a complement for Adam. Now we're going to look for another complement, just as an example to help us get the idea. The search on page 3, and I perceived on the right hand of him who is sitting on the throne a scroll, written in front and on the back and sealed up with 7 seals. And I perceived a strong messenger heralding with a loud voice, "Who's worthy to open the scroll or to loose its seals?" And no one in heaven, nor yet on earth, nor yet underneath the earth was able to open the scroll, neither to look at it. Here is a search of heaven and earth and under the earth. Here's a search of heaven and earth and hell, Hades. Where is someone that can open this scroll? You know, Jesus is the only one that's been, I don't know if citizen is the right word, but he's the only one who's been a citizen of heaven, a citizen of earth, and a citizen of Hades, isn't he? Is anybody else? And he's the one who's going to rule all of them. And I lamented, this is John speaking in Revelation, I lamented much that no one was found worthy to open the scroll, neither to look at it. And one of the elders is saying to me, "Do not lament. Lo, look here, he conquers. The lion out of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, is to open the scroll and to loose its 7 seals." And I perceived, and in the center of the throne and of the 4 animals and in the center of the elders, a lambkin standing as though slain, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God, commissioned for the entire earth. And it came and has taken the scroll out of the right hand of him who is sitting on the throne. He's called the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, and yet when we see him, he's looks like a lamb that's been slain, the sacrifice. And it's through that sacrifice that he conquers to be able and be qualified to open that scroll. 3 realms were searched, and this was not a Cinderella search, okay? The strong angel didn't take the scroll with all these seals on it and go around to all the angels in heaven, see if you can open this, you know, and nobody can. Goes through all humanity, and then he goes down and raises the dead in Hades, Can you open this up? Oh, nobody. God knows us, all right? God knows who's capable of what. But what this search does is it shows us that God chooses who is qualified to do a job that he wants done. And he's got the knowledge, and he knows how to do it. Let's look at another search here, just below. It's from Psalm 53, verses 2 and 3. Elohim, he gazes down from the heavens on the sons of humanity to see whether there is anyone acting intelligently, anyone seeking after Elohim. Everyone is turned away. Together they are spoiled. There is no one doing good. There is not even one. This sounds like Paul in Romans chapter 3, doesn't it? Yeah, that's exactly where this is quoted to us. Wow, what a thing. When God was looking for the Messiah, I think this is the kind of thing, who's going to go and who's going to go to the cross. I think he did a search. In Hebrews 1 and 2, I think he searched the celestial realm. What's the theme of Hebrews 1 and 2? Ted, what's Hebrews? He's written so much and studied so much on this. What's the main theme in 1 and 2?
Christ is superior to all the angelic realm.
Yeah. Christ is better than angels. Christ is better than angels. And in the middle of the eons, and this is where we get the timing off, but after man was born, created, and multiplied, and the flood, and the Tower of Babel, and Israel, and all this, after all these generations of humanity, it's obvious and it's clear. There's not going to be one single human born as a sinner who's qualified. So God searches heaven and earth, and he sends the one. Genesis 2, 18 through 24, is a search of the celestial realm of spiritual beings and the earthly realm of human beings to try and find a complement for Christ. But we have the Adam representing him there. But it's represented by Adam and the animals. Christ came in the middle of the eons after it was shown that none of the angelic realm and no human born to mortal sinners was suitable to be Christ's complement. Well, God made a search and he came up empty. Yeah, didn't he? That's what we see in Genesis 2. Adam searching through heaven and earth, the animals of the realms, didn't find anyone. So what does God do when a search comes up empty? Is he out of options? No. No, God was ready. And this is more for our learning than it is anything else. Adam's sleep, his deep sleep, when God opened his side and took part of his body, represents the death of Christ. The rib by interpretation means a side. It's a very common word. It's a construction term used in the building of the tabernacle and the temples many times. And you're going to notice here at the bottom of the page, I just drew some empty lines. And I'd like for you to write something because, well, it says here, there are three things represented here that God specifically guarded. God was very careful about some things. In Deuteronomy 21, 22, and 23, it says, anyone who is hanged on a tree, and someone who was executed, maybe stoned, I don't know if they hung them and stoned them while they were hanging or stoned them and hung them up as an object lesson in Israel, but anyone hanging on a tree has to be taken down and buried that day. If you leave it hanging, you're going to defile the land. That's God's law. Another law God had, there is no bone of a Passover lamb was to be broken. Okay? Remember how all this played out? It's really interesting. Christ was crucified. And then the chief priests got a hold of Pilate and they said, look, we got to get these guys off the cross. It's against our laws and so forth to have them here, especially on the holidays. I mean, this is our big day of the year. So let's get these guys out of here. And when they're hanging on a pole or a cross or a pole, whichever it was, they had a little foot piece and they had to be able to push themselves up to breathe. And then they could relax for a minute. But they had to keep either pulling themselves up or pushing themselves up to breathe. And so if they wanted them to die quickly, they would break their legs and they would suffocate. Jesus Christ is a true Passover lamb. God says he's got to be off the cross by sundown. God says you can't break any of his bones. So what do? These soldiers go out and they're starting to break their legs and everything, but they come to Christ and he's dead already. And Pilate even was surprised. He asked the centurion, are you sure he's dead? And he says, yeah, I saw him die. As a matter of fact, that centurion was amazed because Christ cried out with a loud voice and he gave up the spirit and the earth quaked and rocks were broken and Christ died right there. We need to... Ted, you want to read a couple of verses for me?
Yeah.
Why don't you get John 10, 17, and 18? Rick Schmidt, you're looking at me like you're ready to read. Why don't you get John 19? And I'd like, in a moment I'd like you to read 31 through 37. John 19, 31 through 37. You ready? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get all this together in my mind. All these things. Why does God have these laws? And Ted, go ahead.
Therefore, the Father is loving me, seeing that I am laying down my soul that I may be getting it again. No one is taking it away from me, but I am laying it down of myself. I have the right to lay it down, and I have the right to get it again. This precept I got from my Father.
One of the reasons the leg couldn't be broken, one of the reasons it had to be taken down, was to really make it obvious that Christ didn't die. What if the legs of Christ had been broken? What if he was alive when the soldiers got there and they broke his legs and he suffocated? He would not have voluntarily laid his life down, would he? You see how important that is. You know, there's a lot of people today, they get so depressed or whatever, they might take their life, a gun or drugs or crash or something, but it's always something else that actually kills them. When you're young, you do a bunch of stupid stuff, and one of the stupid things I did, we would work ourselves like a bunch of push-ups real fast, get really breathing, and then hold your breath and you pass out. And I know it's stupid, but
No, we did it on the back of the bus. I joined you.
But once you pass out, you start breathing again. You know, you can't just lay your life down. But Christ got this commandment from his Father, and he could do that. And I don't know how, I can't imagine how hard that would be, but that's God's love for us, you know. Rick Schmidt, read for us, please. And these verses are written down. Those references are on your sheet. So go ahead, Rick.
John 19, verse 31.
Yes.
The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was an high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken, that they might be taken away. Then came the soldiers and brake the legs of the first and of the other which was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water. And he that saw it bare record, and his record is true. And he knows that he says true, that you might believe. For these things were done, that the scripture should be fulfilled. A bone of him shall not be broken. And again, another scripture says, they shall look on him whom they pierced.
Thank you, Rick. I'm going to mention two verses you might want to write down. I failed to. And these are verses that talk about Christ being pierced. Zechariah 12:10 and Revelation 1:7. Zechariah 12:10 and Revelation 1:7. God, with these laws about the bones and the taking, he was guarding the fact, he was controlling the fact that Christ's side could be pierced. He did that. And when he did that, he fulfilled a typical prophecy of Adam. Mm-hmm. Do you see how all those things? And I put those lines there. If you kind of get the idea of all these things working together, I'd like you just in your own words, maybe jot down a note so that we just see God working all these things together and how important they were. I'm going to hurry up here. I want to finish up quickly here on the last page. A complement was not created or made, as the words used in Genesis 1 of humanity. Wasn't formed, as the word used of Adam in chapter 2, but it was built. And the King James is incorrect with made. It should be the word built. And the Bible speaks of the building of things, of the temple and the tabernacle and all these. And look at the words of the Apostle Paul as he talks about Christ's complement of the church. The complement of Christ is God's dwelling place in spirit, like the building of a temple, the building of a tabernacle. It is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, and it's growing into a holy temple. Some people get sort of frustrated. They say Paul's just mixing up his metaphors here. He talks about growing and building together. Well, look what he's copying. He's copying a living being coming into existence when Eve was created. And yet God says that she was built. He speaks of it in coming to the measure of the stature of the complement of Christ in accord with the operation of the measure of each one's part. He's making for the growth of the body, for the upbuilding of itself in love. And the word we have in the New Testament so many times, edifying. To edify, that means to build or to build up. And so this word for the idea of building is used with the church in the New Testament over and over again. Come right in, and we're ignoring you. Adam and Eve were actually one flesh, the secret of two becoming one flesh. Eve was made from Adam's flesh. A married couple are one in many ways, but they're literally one flesh in their children. The new life of a child is a life of two joined into one. It grows within like the life of God's Spirit in us. The flesh of Christ was changed at his death. It's sown a soulish body, it's raised, aroused a spiritual body. Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living soul, the last Adam a vivifying spirit. As the celestial one, such are those also who are celestials, will be of the same kind of body as he. And according as we wear the image of the soulish, we should be wearing the image also of the celestial. And I'd like you, when you ever think about your relationship to Christ and our future glorification, it may help to think of Adam and Eve. Where was Eve before the deep sleep fell on Adam? She was in Adam. What does Paul say over and over about us? We are in Christ. We're entombed together with him through baptism into death. Adam was there symbolically dead with Eve and him and brought out, and we are dead with Christ and raised with him. There is so much in these figures that I think have a tremendous amount of encouragement for us and a lot of food for thought. So I hope you'll think on these things. Thank you.
Amen.
There you go.
Okay, folks, 10 after we'll get started.
How was the chipmunk? Do you like the chipmunk?
I love you. I love you.